Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski, and I got my co-host here, super endocrinologist, Dr. Carl Nadolski Jr. And today we're going to be talking about the brand new, just released ACE algorithm for the evaluation treatment of adults with obesity, adiposity-based chronic disease, ACE, American Association of Clinical Endocrinology, of which my brother is basically the leader of.
Hey, I was the lead author, for better or worse.
You were the lead author. We wanted to make sure that we did not do this podcast before it was released, because last time my brother did that for the liver guidelines. If anybody remembers that, probably not. A couple of years back,
we tried to time it out, and
he got demoted. Anyway, okay, so here's an algorithm. These aren't guidelines. Is it more of an algorithm? A little bit more, I would say, practical.
Yeah.
Kind of just being like, okay, this is what you need to do, as opposed to like the whole guideline thing. It's a whole thing. Anyway, so we're gonna go over this today.
Yeah, and this is my first time like going through this for anybody else, and so I thought this would be a good opportunity because we're pretty casual and we like to translate, you know, clinical guidance for patients, since that's like our whole life is making sure patients can get something out of this. And this has been a long project, as you know, lots of ins and outs. Coming to consensus based upon good evidence is a lot easier said than done. And I'll tell you, they threw the monkey wrench of the whole Lancet commission at us while we were in the process of this, and that caused a substantial delay in debate. So I'll try to talk it out a little bit. And what does it even mean, Basil? What does it matter?
Yeah, if anybody remembers, the Lancet Commission was the whole thing where they made the definitions of preclinical and clinical obesity. And so we've talked about that a little bit before. So it's going to come up here a little bit.
And maybe in the future we'll get my second author, who's really been my mentor in ACE endocrinology guideline development, Tim Garvey, who's been an expert at this for long before we were even in med school. He was on that commission, and so he was able to give us some insight while they were working on it and how we could kind of reconcile it, but more to what we think is actually practical and reasonable. So just to kind of get going, you know, the ACE principles are now asked to be in all of our guidelines and clinical practice algorithms. So here's a principles of person-centered, complication-centric management of obesity or adiposity-based chronic disease. So you can see we just have 9 real important principles we think need to be prioritized. 1, emphasize that it's about the whole person health, and it's not just about BMI. So we actually say de-emphasize BMI. It seems like people have been saying that forever. Everyone knows that, and we'll talk about how it's still helpful for screening and classification, but really it's about people's health. I always say it's what's on the inside that counts. What is obesity? What harm is obesity causing, or what risk of it is there, and focus on that. And, you know, really clinicians need to be empathetic. Healthcare professionals of all sorts need to be empathetic towards people struggling with their weight. And it needs to be a chronic treatment program. And so that's basically what number 2 is saying, with a good healthcare professional and a team that's helping not just for the weight loss, but make sure the treatment goals are optimized for their health. Number 3 is about the anthropometrics. When we say anthropometrics, that's like body mass index, weight, height to weight, waist circumference, body composition, and
anything you could measure, like body.
And so, there are different ways to essentially estimate body fat that correlates to excess adipose tissue that is consistent with obesity, the disease of obesity, excess adipose tissue that's potentially causing harm. And so body mass index is can be part of that, but we have to, pay attention to the clinical aspect of a patient. Like, does it actually reflect increased adipose tissue? Or are they very thin, but they have excess adipose tissue and not much muscle? And we'll get to that in one of the slides. But all the other aspects, you know, waist circumference, waist to height, body composition. So those are needed.
Just in a second.
Number four, it's the clinical component.
Hold on. Yeah. I get this alerts on Reddit now where people mention us. And okay, someone was like, so tons of people are like, you should listen to Docs Who Lift. And they made a comment like, yeah, you really shouldn't be focusing on the whole anthropometric only. Shout out to the Docs Who Lift where I learned that term. I thought it was so funny. I was like, heck yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
They learned the term anthropometric from one of us.
So yeah, that just means measurement of the body, basically. So
yeah.
But more importantly, number four, the clinical component. So this is where we really stage the severity of disease. And this is gets into the whole Lancet Commission, preclinical, clinical obesity stuff we'll talk about. And then, you know, really individualizing and personalizing health goals with, you know, a target weight loss that's actually expected to achieve those goals. Number six, obviously, comprehensive treatment plans. Certainly lifestyle, you know, we are lifestyle shills. I'm very proud of the lifestyle slide. Maybe we'll spend the most time on that one, but also medications and surgical options for people to lose weight and get healthier. Long-term goals of therapy, really all about health. And then, making sure that we're continuing beyond just behavior, lifestyle therapy for any medication surgeries that need to be long-term. So that's really kind of those are the principles. But let's just get into it. So this is a care model for screening and diagnosis. So we still, you know, we talk about screening via BMI, mostly because that's so established and it is pretty good on a population basis, as we've talked about over and over again. But we also have to think about patients who maybe are thinner, don't have an elevated body mass index, but maybe they don't have a lot of muscle. Maybe they have what we call sarcopenic obesity. And maybe they already have things that we know are related to obesity, like diabetes and whatnot. And they actually do have the bigger picture of what we call adiposity-based chronic disease. And so over there on the left, you see the anthropometric component. And then on the right, the clinical component. And we use a lot of history and exam and biochemical testing and blood pressure testing, you know, maybe sleep studies, et cetera. So then we split this slide up and we talk, the next slide is really just the anthropometric screening and classification. So now everyone's going to love that term anthropometrics. So body mass index, classifying it, you know, that can help us say, well, where are they in terms of the classification? But really, you know, we need to consider using more body composition techniques to confirm it, the clinical exam to confirm it, and then waist circumference. And we also added the waist to height ratio that's now being recommended more like the European Association for the Study of Obesity and other parts of the world, because it's a pretty easy ratio to test and it's kind of consistent across the board of that 0.5. I don't know, what do you think of that? Because I don't specifically do that in all my patients.
No, I don't do
it. But I think it's interesting.
What I do like about this slide is that you go into the ethnicity differences. I think that's really good because it doesn't seem like there's been one unifying guideline for this. Like you talk about the BMI of like over 25 in the Asia Pacific region, and then that's for obesity, and then 23 to just under 25 for overweight. But then, yeah, you have the different waist circumferences there, the European, African, Middle Eastern differences compared to the United States, and then the Asian differences. I think that's great. The waist to height ratio, I mean, if anybody knows this in practice, there's doctors, nurse practitioners, PAs listening, MAs listening maybe, and RN, who maybe have said, hey, the doctor, like, can you start getting a waist circumference on people? It's easier said than done. You have to be very careful. You got to go parallel to the floor. It's not where your umbilicus is, your belly button is. You actually have to feel the sides of your hips and feel where your hip bones, the top of your iliac crests are, and go directly around parallel to the floor. And that there can be a lot of variance there. And then you'd have to ideally your EMR would do a quick calculation.
That's what would be nice. Well, and I'll, you know, talk about the waist circumference measurements. So back when I gave this talk like 10 years ago, when we first did this, I had learned, I had to learn about the different types of waist circumference measurements. And there have historically been two different ways to do it. So one is actually between the rib and the upper part of the iliac, mm-hmm. and then one's at the top of the leg. And so depending on the studies done. And so, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it almost doesn't matter that much unless we're trying to be very good about like the research. I think from a clinical perspective, it's still pretty good. You know, you can go around. It doesn't change that much when you go up and down, to be honest. I'd like the EMR to calculate that waist to height ratio, because I think that would be interesting to do more of the actual practice. The data are there. I mean, it's pretty simple. It's like 0.5 for everyone. So,
and it makes sense because you're storing it centrally. You're going to notice it in that waist to height ratio.
Yeah. Yeah. And so then that goes back to, it's not just about BMI, right? So if someone has a relatively low BMI, but we have concerns if they have these adiposity-based diseases like type 2 diabetes, dyslipidemia, insulin resistance, and then we do the waist circumference, but then the waist to height seems to be a little bit easier and simpler of a number to remember anyway. So
there's also the body roundness index we have.
Some of our friends, the barbell medicine guys, were talking about that recently.
Yeah. There's another calculation.
We'll see, but I think it needs more research to
validate. It's all
in the validate.
It's all a similar concept.
Yeah. Anyways, that's that part. But
the Lilly and I believe Novo both removed the BMI component from their indication, which that's the thing for me now. There are some patients that come in with like a 23, 24, and they have these adiposity based chronic diseases along with it. And I'm looking at their waist and everything like that. And it's like, you got that disease of obesity there, the clinical obesity. So it's a good one.
Yeah. So I think that's interesting. So especially think about those Asian populations who, you know, maybe have a BMI of 23, very literally, but they really do have the disease of obesity, or at least the adiposity-based chronic disease concept. And people might say, oh my God, we don't want to give them medicine to help them lose more weight. But actually, if you look at the studies done on these patients, and I'm talking about like for fatty liver specifically, for diabetes, weight loss, regardless of those BMIs for these diseases, have the same benefits. And so, I mean, I remember I did a little commentary or something back when they talked about the lean MASH, like the lean fatty liver. I was like, they're not actually lean. I hate that word. And because they have adiposity-based Crohn's disease. So when they lost 10% of their weight, they fixed the stuff.
You're like,
however that was diet, exercise,
most of us, whatever. You gave them a picture of yourself. You're like, that's not lean. This is lean.
Yeah, exactly. On the other hand, I mean, well, this could get really complicated, but we get into lipodystrophies and stuff where people look really lean, but it's all being stored in their visceral area in their liver and stuff. And they have some of the worst disease possible.
Yeah, I had a patient in private like 10 years ago who had HIV lipodystrophy. And their arms were jacked.
It was shredded.
I'm like, Jesus, man. It was interesting.
But probably pretty bad insulin resistance and maybe high triglycerides and all the things.
Yeah.
Anthropometrics, it really needs to be more of an exam and a personalized diagnostic approach. But more importantly, we would argue is the clinical component of the diagnosis. And this is really where we stage. This is kind of the ABCD staging that we have. And so to partly reconcile with the whole Lancet Commission, they really differentiated between obesity-related diseases and complications. And we argued back and forth about this. And this is where, you know, we talked to somebody online recently about somebody presented a little picture of the Lancet Commission talking about preclinical obesity, clinical obesity, and one of the patients had elevated weight, right? And prediabetes.
Yeah.
And because of the way that they divvied up the definitions in that Lancet Commission, it didn't really count as a complication, which doesn't make any sense.
No.
And because we know for sure that obesity-related insulin resistance, prediabetes is very treatable with weight loss. That's one of the earliest, most definitive things we know from the diabetes prevention programs. And so we decided as a consensus group to say, let's just combine these terms. Because when we stage the severity of obesity using the ABCD construct, it's all the obesity-related diseases and complications that matter. It doesn't have to be an end organ damage the way they describe. And so this is a relatively simple concept without perfect exact parameters. And that's frustrating to people. But basically, if you have obesity, anthropometrically, meaning excess adipose tissue, elevated waist circumference, whatever that is, but you absolutely do not have any weight-related disease states that we know of yet, then that would be the stage one. To us, that would be more of that preclinical obesity. You have obesity, you have the risk of it. It's not a benign state, so it still needs to be treated, but you don't have a severe state of the disease. On the other hand, if you have maybe relatively mild prediabetes, you have high triglycerides, low HDL, that's that dyslipidemia that we talk about, fatty liver, but you don't have high risk of fibrosis, you have mild sleep apnea, mild knee arthritis, all these things, we would say that's in a stage two. Certainly needs to be considered a little bit more severe than stage one, should have a little bit more intensity of therapy, but not as urgent per se. Whereas stage three, that's like really severe. So we say at least one severe obesity-related complication or disease, that would be like type 2 diabetes. And then, of course, even within that, you have a whole severity spectrum, right? You could have type 2 diabetes that is requiring tons of medications, including insulin and heart disease and advanced liver fibrosis. But like really any of those sort of advanced severe obesity-related diseases, we would say that stage three, we need to be more aggressive, not only with our obesity therapy, but also the non-obesity, like kind of the related disease therapy too.
Yeah, I think this is better than the Lancet Commission's
good
stuff. Well, just because, and there is, I mean, you should see a lot of the advocacy groups for, you know, obesity are kind of like, hey, the way they worded the preclinical obesity, their insurances will latch onto this, and they will not treat. And what you're saying here in stage one does entail risk of future obesity-related diseases and complications. Even though there aren't any right now, and it's stage one. It's not like a stage zero where it's not. I think that's right. The right way to do it.
That's interesting that you bring that up, because remember when we had that whole stigma conference a couple of years ago, and we used to, in the old guidelines, 2016, we did have it as stage zero, one, and two.
Yeah.
And people brought that up. They said, you know what, stage zero sounds like it's almost too safe.
Yep.
A false sense of security, as Dad would say.
Yeah,
and so we literally changed it to stage one.
I think this is well thought out. For anybody listening, this is the first time I purposely didn't look at this, not only because I wanted to wait for my brother to explain it, but because I just didn't have any time.
So, and then on this slide, we also talk about, you know, what else to consider when evaluating patients who are struggling with their weight. So we obviously, these are things that everybody should do with everything we do in medicine, but sometimes it's hard and they're, you know, things sometimes fall through the cracks, but always think about iatrogenic etiologies. What does that mean? Well, taking medication that promote weight gain. We have a ton of medications out there that people need that promote weight gain and obesity. We, especially in my world, we have to think about, are there any other hormone causes? You know, do somebody have pituitary or adrenal tumors, or, you know, acromegaly, or, you know, hypothyroidism that might be contributing anyways? And then, of course, genetic or syndromic obesities that, you know, we don't need to talk too much about here, but we have some podcasts on that.
We have a whole podcast on the medicines that promote weight gain. So if you're interested, it's like a few years back.
Yeah, it's like 3 years ago.
I mean, do we need to redo these things over? I don't even know. But,
I don't know.
And then we do have multiple endocrinopathy types of podcasts where we've gone over hypothyroidism, Cushing's disease, and some of these other similar ones. When we do have a genetic podcast as well with Dr. Jesse Richards, it was a pretty good one. So
yeah, people like that one.
And then we do have a weight bias one.
Yeah, absolutely. So okay, so then this slide, this is a newer concept that I think people have been talking about for a long time, and we felt like it was time to really put it out there in some guidance. And this is about the response to therapy and weight loss targets for people with these adiposity-based chronic diseases. So how much weight should be targeted to achieve what we expect to be a clinically meaningful benefit? So once upon a time, before we had good medications and even before surgeries, remember people used to say, hey, 3% weight loss will help with blood pressure and triglycerides.
Triglycerides, right.
Yeah. And then it kind of turned into 5% because we know from the intensive lifestyle therapies, you know, 5 to 10% was at least achievable. And that was starting to show diabetes prevention in those with prediabetes. That's from all those diabetes prevention programs. You started to see benefits in people with type 2 diabetes. But then once we started getting some of these newer medications, and even the first generation that we'll talk about in a little bit, if people had a good response to them, like if they had an early response in 3 months of 5% weight loss, they generally were able to achieve 10%. And that's really where we start to see the most benefit for people with these related diseases, like putting diabetes into remission, putting fatty liver kind of into a remission. That's also where we start to see the cardiovascular risk reduction. So even in, you know, some of those old trials with medications that triggered concern about increasing cardiovascular risk, if people lost more than 10%, they actually did have a cardiovascular risk reduction. But now, because we have such good medications, we can start getting over 15% weight reduction, which really starts to put these things into remission, like actual, you know, fibrosis of the liver, MASH, type 2 diabetes, you know, putting things like our metabolic syndrome components, PCOS, into remission, sleep apnea, hence the approval for some of the medications. And so now you might not know these terms, but I thought this was my idea. So if people don't like this, then this is my fault. But it's analogous to thyroid cancer. And so in thyroid cancer, when people, you know, they have surgery, maybe they get radioactive iodine to treat the lingering risk, depending on what the initial risk was. If they end up not having any of the tumor marker or anything seen on like ultrasound or other imaging modalities, we call that an excellent response to therapy because we know that it's so statistically good in the future that they're going to not suffer, you know, recurrence and mortality. And so we have the data to support these terms. We basically just decided to use these terms. So an incomplete response, especially that early response of therapy, if people aren't losing 5% of their weight at 3 to 6 months, that's really an incomplete response because they're not going to be predicted to get that, you know, 10% that really is what we're going to call a good response. And then that 15% weight loss really is an excellent response from a weight perspective because it predicts the clinical benefits. But maybe more importantly than that, it's not just about the weight. So even if someone does lose 15% of their weight, remember, muscle has a lot of weight to it. We don't want people to lose their muscle. That is metabolically very healthy. And so it may not always be perfect. So we have to also consider the clinical response to therapy, which is actually more important than what we care about. So we have both kind of the anthropometric, the weight loss response to therapy, and then the clinical response to therapy that really predicts long-term health outcomes.
Yeah, I mean, I like this show. I'm glad you guys included this because you see this in some of the reviews and then people put it in their slides, but it's never readily available to then show for presentations for, you know, what if I'm doing a presentation, I have to go find this, one of the stupid reviews that did this. So I'm glad this is in a guideline because this is nice. I mean, yeah, it shows, yeah, like, for example, We want to get them at least 10 to 15% to really get some of these more severe complications improved. So I think it's good. Good job.
Yeah. And then basically you just go down. And also this is where we start to get people off of other medications. So, you know, people always say, oh, geez, this is a chronic disease. I might have to be on these medications forever.
Yeah.
But that's true. It is a chronic relapsing disease process. And so we might have to be on medications forever, but you might actually get to get off other medications. And that's always fun. In our world, we get to get people off of insulin all the time. And, you know, and you're probably doing some of that. We reduce blood pressure meds all the time, it seems like.
Yeah, I mean, this is my gripe against most telemedicine pill mill places is that they'll just send you back to your primary care doctor who, you know, you can't get in to see for 3 months. So now you have hypotension because you're on your lisinopril and hydrochlorothiazide and amlodipine, whatever. That's what, you know, we monitor it very closely. Are you having any dizziness? Because like tirzepatide, I mean, people just, their blood pressure start dropping quickly. So
because we're treating the root issue. And so, yeah, there's a plug for a Spencer's online thing. If you're going to do an online
pill mill or shot mill. Find one that's actually comprehensive and actually is going to take care of the whole person. That's what you've tried to do with your online efforts. Right. And
I just started. I do a lot of combo statins and ezetimibe. I'm like trying to treat all the spectrum of it. So,
as you should.
Anyway,
that's the right thing to do. These places that all they do is sell you prescriptions for weight loss. Yeah, medicine. That's not obesity medicine. That's
we can get people sleep studies now, and it's pretty cool.
Perfect. All right, here's my favorite slide. So this is where I was certainly the most passionate about, because you know we are always debating people online about nutrition and exercise and all the things for obesity therapy. And we know that nutrition is really the most important for weight loss per se, but that physical activity, exercise is so incredibly important to incorporate for the health of the person. So, you know, let's just talk about the nutrition aspect. See what you think of this, because this is like our bread and butter, no pun intended. And so, you know, we really prioritize that you have to find a way, no matter what the strategy is, to create some sort of energy deficit or a reduced calorie diet while trying to maintain the best dietary quality you can. So that's like the first and foremost important thing. And, you know, we talk about in the actual text, you know, we have the different healthful meal patterns. So we have dietary patterns that are healthy, but also translate into potentially causing an energy deficit, like a Mediterranean diet, minimally processed foods, nutrient-dense foods. You know, we say limit energy-dense foods and beverages. I will tell you that the one thing I tell everyone, and I know you do too, is please don't drink your sugary calories. That's the one thing we tell you not to do. Everything else we can kind of personalize and use all these evidence-based nutrition strategies to come up with an individualized plan. But we can do low carb, we can do low fat, we can do a little mixture of both. We know meal replacement strategies have some of the best, most robust, definitive data for weight loss and like diabetes remission type stuff. We can do types of intermittent fasting, we can do time-restricted feeding. We can have caloric plans for people. People can count their calories, but we can mix and match and do all of these things together. None of that likes to get any traction online and social media, because you have to have an extreme push to make any money. But really, they all actually have data behind them, and we can mix and match them for all individual patients.
Yeah, I mean,
what are your thoughts on that?
I don't see anything unreasonable about that. It's kind of just like giving very, very, very reasonable evidence-based recommendation for nutrition, which we all know is the most important part of reducing one's weight.
And then, to be cliche for the Docs Who Lift podcast, we get to the physical activity over here on the upper right-hand training. And, you know, so we have a whole text section about this, but incorporating aerobic activity, resistance training, and breaking up or reducing sedentary behavior. And you'll see the little asterisks by the resistance training, because we all agreed that we need to shift exercise prescription historically to focus and prioritize strength training, because especially with the medications and surgeries we have that help people lose weight now, we really, really, really want to prioritize maintaining, maybe even gaining for some people who've never done it, muscle mass, because muscles are essentially like our little metabolic health factories. We have to optimize them, maintain them, use them, and get them as big and strong and healthy as possible.
Well, someone should message Dr. John Jakizic and tell him I won that.
I know. I have a little bit of a conflict of interest for that debate. But
that was if anybody remembers, a couple of years ago, I debated one of the best, like, most renowned exercise obesity researchers. He obviously took the aerobic training side. I took the resistance training side. Obviously, at the end, we agreed that you should do both. But I really said, look, because of the powerful medicines that are out, the resistance training should take the focus, simply because I just think aerobic training, you should do it, of course. But like,
it's good for you.
To continue to do it at the volumes that is needed to have the huge, the benefits for weight specifically are so high that I personally don't even get as much as they recommend, the 300 minutes a week.
It's so hard.
So anyway, I agree. I think it's good. I'm glad that more people are taking the resistance training more seriously.
Yeah. Well, and you know, when we look at the studies for weight loss, so forget the medicines, forget anything else. When we have the trials, and this is where he was basically, you know, kind of, I guess, winning the technical question of your debate, because I think it was
more data.
It was strength training versus aerobic for weight loss per se, as opposed to treating obesity and adiposity-based chronic disease, which is really what we're saying. Because on average, in all the studies with really good exercise intervention without the nutrition part, without medicine, the average is like 2% weight loss. You know what I mean? And that's with a ton of aerobic activity. And it is a little bit more weight loss than strength training, technically. But again, that's a weight-centric approach. And we care about the overall health of the person. Yeah.
And only looking at exercise, mind you. Because if you look at the total picture, it's like, whoa, hold on a second. Because we're not assuming that you're going to use your exercise to help people lose a lot of weight. It's going to be a little bit beneficial. Yeah. But
it's not the Biggest Loser with Jillian Michaels.
No. My God.
All right. And then, of course,
go to sleep.
You know, sleep's the unsung hero, I think, of lifestyle medicine. Sleep is so important, ranging from sleep habits, sleep hygiene, to obviously when we're talking about obesity, obesity-related obstructive sleep apnea, because if you have that, that's not treated, you feel like garbage. It causes you to, you know, have functional hypogonadism, low testosterone, et cetera. And so sleep has to be prioritized. I always tell patients, I don't have necessarily a magic wand for it, but we have to work on our sleep habits, our sleep hygiene, get sleep studies if necessary, and really focus on that. I
think. Another reason to screen for menopause, because so many of my patients, it's like nobody asks them. I'm like, so are you sleeping okay? Are you having half? Oh, Yella, you mentioned it. My sleep's terrible. I'm like, oh my God.
All the time. It's a big deal.
Yeah. So I think it's good. Shout out if anybody has troubles with sleep and needs help, you should follow my friend, sleep doctor Shelby.
Shelby, yeah.
She's my personal cognitive behavioral therapy sleep doctor. Very good. So check her out on.
And let's be clear, you need that cognitive behavioral sleep therapy.
Well, I just need cognitive behavioral therapy.
We all do. God. Okay. And then behavioral therapy just in general. So we got to think about people's mental health. We know that like obesity and diabetes come with a lot of mental health potential complications, and so we need to make sure we're supporting people's behavioral adherence, in all those ways, but also paying attention to their mental health. It's very important. You know, disordered eating too, the internalized weight bias we've talked about. I have people every day. I just had a patient today. She said when we first met, I talked about the pathology of obesity, and I told her, you know, because she basically was blaming herself. I was like, well, it's not your fault. It's the biology, and she has held on to that and said, wow, that really makes me feel better. And now she's on therapy and she's doing great and she's so happy.
Yeah. So that's tough. We just hired a psychologist too, because we just see so many issues. And I'm not a trained psychologist. I'll try to help. And our dietitians are amazing, but they're not trained psychologists either. So it's I think that's good. Also, you know, monitoring, I think this is something good to monitor whenever patients come in, even when they're on the medicines. They're not even coming to see me for that. It's you'll see all sorts of different things.
Absolutely. All right. And so then we get into the medications, and this is, we're the first ones to really start putting in these hierarchies of preferred medications for people with specific weight-related diseases based upon the evidence thus far. Of course, very literally, at the same time this was published, we have all these new publications coming out, you know, the European Association for the Study of Diabetes, and pretty soon the SURPASS cardiovascular outcome trial will actually be published. Of course, that's in diabetes specifically, but the basics of this, if you look up at the top, so people with prediabetes, metabolic syndrome, and the goal of really preventing hyperglycemia diabetes, obviously the best medications that have the most robust evidence are the tirzepatide, semaglutide, GLP-1 receptor agonists, and then we have really good data for liraglutide, which was kind of the OG GLP that was approved for obesity, kind of like Victoza, Saxenda, but also the phenermine topiramate that I think not enough people utilize these days. It's really, for right now, the best oral form of weight loss medication we have, and it has pretty good diabetes prevention data. And even the old orlistat, which now it seems like we only use to help people with their constipation.
I got a lot of patients on orlistat for constipation. Yeah, I know. Secondary.
That's,
to
it's kind of like it's like only obesity specialists use this.
Can we please get who's making this stuff? We got to talk to the company making and see if we can do an RCT.
Yeah, it's yes. I know that's a good. Yeah, let's do it.
They're not going to.
And then, of course, if you have type 2 diabetes, obviously very, very similar. But basically, all the medicines have some good benefits. Obviously, with tirzepatide, semaglutide, having not only just the weight loss benefits, but very, very robust glycemic benefits and kind of comprehensive benefits. If you look over to the left, when we say MACE prevention, that's major adverse cardiovascular events. Semaglutide and liraglutide, as of the publication for this, have the established data to show that it's beneficial. Semaglutide specifically in obesity with established heart disease showed a reduction in events. And we sure think that now with the SURPASS cardiovascular outcome trial, comparing it to its predecessor of Trulicity and type 2 diabetes, having similar, if not better, benefits, we could start to include that in there. We have really good data for the fatty liver, the metabolic associated steatohepatitis, and especially if they have fibrosis, the tirzepatide and semaglutide. Semaglutide is actually now approved for that indication. I expect tirzepatide will at some point too. The blood pressure lowering, kidney disease, semaglutide, tirzepatide have the most benefit for those. We have the heart failure data in semaglutide, tirzepatide. And then also the biomechanical things over there in the orange, you know, semaglutide has the data for knee arthritis. Now, obviously, we would expect tirzepatide also or anything to, you know, that goes back to the targeted weight loss. So, you know, we start getting over 10, 15%. We should be getting these benefits anyways, but we have the data to support semaglutide and arthritis and then tirzepatide and even phenamine topiramate for obstructive sleep apnea, which has the indication for tirzepatide.
Yeah. Cool. No, this looks good.
All right. Okay, moving on. All right, now this is where we fight because this is where
tirzepatide for everybody.
Yeah, I know. This is where Spencer says, give it to everybody. Everyone, you know, the whole world's going to go broke.
Tirzy or GTF.
Everyone needs it. So this slide we felt like was very important for that exact debate because one, not everyone can afford it because they have to pay out of pocket. But also, you know, this is where we have to figure out a way to be more cost-effective stewards of whether it's insurance or government money or people's money. Because if you have one of those severe indications for those specific medications, like you have diabetes, pre-diabetes, fatty liver, all those things, then those really, really are preferred. But if you don't, especially so we're kind of talking that stage one, maybe it's stage two, ABCD sort of thing, then at least we should start thinking about cost-effective options, depending on if people want to pay out of pocket or not, and then really seeing how they respond. So we have phenermine topiramate, we have naltrexone bupropion, we have phenermine by itself. By the way, I had a patient, and it was today or yesterday, with very severe, not only severe ABCD, but like a BMI of like 50 or something like that, and didn't tolerate semaglutide at some point. Got on phenermine and had just by itself, phenermine monotherapy, cheap, by itself, ended up having like a 22% weight loss and putting other obesity-related diseases into remission. And so what this slide is basically going back to that good or excellent response to therapy, insufficient response to therapy and changing it up, and then maybe having to go on to more advanced, those second-generation medications.
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of success with Qsymia or phentermine topiramate.
Yeah. Oh, tons.
Phentermine.
Yeah.
It's the only issue I really wish there was the cardiovascular outcome trial with it. That would make things like everybody, you know, could be using that.
Again, that's for, you know, if we're talking about people with established or very high risk cardiovascular disease, then really we know for sure that semaglutide has the data. And so that's pretty hard to argue against. And that's where going to that other slide. But
the only thing is liraglutide is just, it's still expensive anyway. So like,
which is too bad, even though it's generic now. So hopefully that will change. Maybe, you know, we talk about compounding pharmacies all the time. They should now be able to do liraglutide legally and safely. I don't understand.
The generics are still pay. Like it's a whole
yeah, thing. I know. It's frustrating.
So it should just be cheap.
But just know that if you don't have a compelling indication for one of those more expensive medications, we do have other cost-effective therapies to try, depending on your, your risks, the benefits, the other medications you might be on, and of course, tolerance, and then ultimately response to therapy. And we have great success with some of those.
Yeah, bupropion and naltrexone, those just rarely.
It does have to be the right people. And if you choose the right people, then it's if they respond to it, though. I have some people that respond. You know, it's not as much. And we just tell them that right up front. But people who, you know, talk about kind of that, the cravings, the food addiction, they may be people who respond very well to it. And if they do, they're going to continue to do well to it. A lot of it's tolerance, too, though.
Yeah, like it's like they're getting headaches, they're getting nausea from the naltrexone, they're getting blood pressure spikes, they're getting anxiety, insomnia from the bupropion. Really interesting.
Yeah. So, and then the last couple slides here. This is just a big slide with all the medications available. Other than we didn't put in the slides the setmelanotide for the rare monogenic obesity and syndromics. There's a section in the text about it, but because it's not as commonly used, we didn't put it in this slide where it kind of goes through all the commonly used medications and then some of the obesity-related diseases or other things that are potentially afflicting patients and whether or not, hey, this is kind of a blue or green light, go for it, this one's really beneficial, or no data, or have some caution, you know, monitor, or hey, there's actually some potential contraindications, specifically hepatic impairment. Now, interestingly, you know, you mentioned the heart risk and stuff. Phenermine, just because it has it in the label still, it's contraindicated with established atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. But I'll argue that because of the studies with phenermine topiramate long-term, it's not contraindicated in that. And I think going back to those studies that I talked about, if you get more than 10% weight loss and we've had no signal of heart concern with these medications, then I'd argue it shouldn't be contraindicated, but we can't help it because it's in the label, as you pointed out.
But the 10% is a post hoc analysis, though.
That was with sibutramine, which was taken off the market for it. But we have other data to show. 10% is kind of the threshold.
Who's going to pay for this? Nobody's going to pay for that.
Yeah. Well,
the NIH sure as hell is.
Oh God, dang. So that's basically it. And then this last slide is more for clinicians, but also patients may appreciate it just because it kind of goes down the mechanism of action, the approval ages for it, how it's delivered, the starting dose, the dose escalations, maximum dosing, the expected or at least the weight reduction average in the trials from previously, the potential side effects to consider, and the cautions and contraindications, and of course the cost. You see the little things down there. So
I know absolutely with 100% certainty that you enjoyed putting flatulence under Orlistat.
I especially the fecal urgency and oily stools.
You enjoyed putting that there. Yeah, this is
all right. Let's see if I can see this now.
This is a good little there you go. Yeah, no, I think you guys did a good job. I'd have to look at some of this other, but you go into the mechanism. It seems like, to me, you know, nothing against all these other guidelines that people have put out, but some of them are just not even helpful. This is very much more to the point, practical. It has all the information anybody would ever need to understand how to prescribe, why, and to understand pathophysiology and the clinical ramifications of the staging. I don't know. This is really good.
Yeah, thank you. So I had you in mind all the time. I was like, I gotta make Spencer proud, since he doesn't want to be involved in making this himself.
Yeah, well, because unfortunately,
someone's got to make some money.
I'm a capitalist.
I'm a martyr.
If anybody's listening, there's certain conflicts of interest. So you know, I was a small percent owner in the company Sequence, which was then bought by Weight Watchers, and at the time I have stock in Weight Watchers, and this is one of those things where they try to be very careful about who has conflicts of interest. Now that I don't own that, I got rid of all my stock and all that, I guess I could do it, but now I just took some money from Novo for the first time, doing one of their advisory boards, planning on doing it for Eli Lilly too. And in the you know, we've talked about this too before, just an aside, The money that I take from that goes towards helping. I give free care to certain individuals who wouldn't be able to afford it otherwise, because I'm like, well, I'll make the best use of this.
Yeah, which is nice. So even though we're going to try to turn into some pharma shills, I've had to decline conflicts of interest at all in the realm of related to any of this stuff for years while we've been working on the Stern guidelines. So maybe someday I'll do this.
Eli Lilly better start paying up. You better start praising some Terzi. King Terzi,
yeah.
Although, and then Retatrutide when it comes out, man, that's going to be, yeah. It's going to be good. Although all the bodybuilders right now are like, just do it right now, get a gray market. I'm like, please, like, I'm not risking
it. I had a patient the other day who said he was buying compounded Retatrutide. I'm like, oh my God, that's going to be reserved for people with very severe obesity, high BMIs, severe disease, you know, type 2 diabetes, stuff like that. That can't just be thrown around. It's way too powerful.
This stuff is powerful. I have a lot of patients that have basically plateaued on the tirzepatide, and it's like, no, they clinically need another 10-20% total body weight loss to have an effect. And that's what I'm going to be switching them. So, well, thanks for going over this. Very good. Yeah. If anybody is interested in, like, any doctors that are listening to this, nurse practitioner, anybody's practicing medicine, patients, I would just take away from this that, like, hey, if you want to find a comprehensive understanding of how obesity is treated, this is a very good algorithm, and it kind of goes through, like, the whole complicated, all this clinical stuff that we talk about. It actually seems to be everything we talk about in one document.
Yeah. And maybe the lifestyle slide would be something that patients would actually be able to look at and understand, oh, there are lots of different ways I can do my diet and exercise and prioritize strength training and all that stuff. So hopefully it's patient.
I'm going to take this, put it into a little ebook, and sell it for $10 each.
I know you.
What we should do is we should, like, basically let AI turn this into a patient-friendly version. That's what I actually would like to do that.
Yeah, somehow. Actually, you could do that. You could have Claude do it, GPT, and then Claude kind of clean it up, and then have a graphic designer that's AI as well. Just make it.
Yeah.
Very cool.
I did hear about this morning about how AI is going to take over in a few years, and there's a chance that human race is going to be wiped out. So, Terminator. Everyone needs to watch Terminator.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Well, I think everybody knows. So. All right, I look forward to that day. Here's our outro, everyone.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll